Welcome to the Barefoot Bootstrap Radio Show. Today is Saturday, July 20th, 2013, and we are broadcasting live on the Freedomizer Radio Network. In this episode, we'll discuss the recent extreme weather in Canada, provide some tips on making a fire starting kit, and we speak to our special guest, Eric Brown, Canadian traveler and explorer. This is your host, AD Venture, and I'm joined by
the Wolfman. Thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in today.
All right, we have a great show lined up for everyone. And we've got a very special guest also that we've been meaning to get on our show for quite some time. But it's been quite a few weeks since we last spoke to all our listeners here on Freedomizer Radio. We did have to go on a slight break last week, and we've been quite busy with a lot of different courses that we've been running and a lot of different people that we've been meeting along our way in our journeys. And we'll have more information for you about that on our website, which is www.barefootbushwrap.com, or you can check out Wolf's blog. And Wolf, what's that blog address again?
My website actually is wolfman.com. And that's Wolfman with two A's. And there's a lot of exciting stories on there. And, of course, copies of our radio show, all sorts of different stuff related to travel and adventure and everything in between.
Absolutely. All right. So we're going to get right on into the show because we have quite a few things to discuss this week.
In good news.
This week we discuss some extreme recent weather that has been battering the entire country of Canada, as well as some portions of the United States and Europe as well. What we currently experienced in Canada has actually ranged throughout the entire lower provinces, from the West Coast and the Pacific Ocean all the way to the Atlantic, and it's been quite extreme. And some of these news articles here that you can see on our Freedomizer chat being posted right now, but what you're looking for is Canada heat waves, and you'll find a lot more on the CBC website and on the Huffington Post. And unfortunately, there's been a fair bit of deaths attributed with these recent heat waves that we've experienced. And right after the heat waves, we've also experienced some massive storms, thunderstorms, tornadoes, and some extreme downpours and such, over flooding of creeks and rivers. And it's been, unfortunately, quite bad for a lot of different people, and there have been a lot of deaths due to that. So what we're going to do now is we're going to discuss a little more on how to prepare for these sorts of experiences, as well as on how to ensure that you stay alive during massive heat waves. Why don't you tell us a little more what you think about that, Wolf?
For sure. It's always nice to talk on our radio show about survival situations that are close to home, in the respect of, we're not talking about zombie apocalypse concepts, we're not talking about end of world, fall of governments, all that sort of thing. Heat waves and floods, all that sort of thing are very, very close to home and can happen at any time to anyone, anywhere. To the point where everybody has, all outdoor operations. It's part of their risk management protocol to prepare for these sort of things. And every time we have a massive heat wave, you will see in the news, you will always see deaths as a result of these massive heat waves. So it will be, people dying because there's lack of power, which is in itself a very bizarre thing to hear that, the power's out and people die. And these aren't people that are required medically to have oxygen machines or whatever. These are regular everyday people. And storm protocols are very, very important for everybody to follow, whether you live in the city or live anywhere else in the world, because they come up fast and I don't know if everybody is well aware of this, but the weather reports, generally speaking, aren't accurate. Many times, the organization I'm currently employed with and running courses for this summer, I put weather up twice a day, and 1 week it said it was thunderstorming out all day, every day for 5 days. I'd step outside the office, and it'd be nice and sunny. so you can't really trust those weather reports. But there's certain things that you can do to always be prepared for the bad weather, of course, like A.D. Venture was saying. You can, always make sure that if you travel by vehicle a lot, make sure you have a gym bag in the vehicle at all times with supplies in it for this kind of thing. So for severe weather, you'd be looking at rain gear, because you never know when your vehicle might break down, might go into a ditch, any number of strange things that you might have to try to brave the weather in this exotic heat. And I'm sure everyone has heard it, but I'm going to say it again. Do not leave your pets or your children in the vehicle. It may be nice and maybe comfortable for you to be in the car when it's hot, but the vehicle will go up to, for our American friends, can go up to 140 degrees very quickly, or for the rest of the world, 45, 50 Celsius in just a few minutes when you leave something in the car that's alive. So it can cause a lot of problems there. Make sure you stay hydrated. Always, always make sure that you have water available. Warm water, even if it's under your car seat, it's better than no water. And it's very, very quick and very easy for all of us to get dehydrated in this weather, especially, us tough guys. I'm okay. I don't need any help. What do you think about that, AD Venture?
Well, that's quite true. And before we actually get into all the different details regarding staying hydrated, we also have to just go back a moment and discuss leaving both pets and human children in cars. And what you can see on the other side of the spectrum, or at least another aspect of this whole situation, is that there have been cases where people have left dogs or children in the car, but you've got a Good Samaritan passing by, seeing this incident and thinking that the occupants of the car were in trouble, broke open the window to find that the car was running with air conditioning and that there wasn't any intending danger to the occupant, whether it be a dog or an animal. Now, the fact that they were left in the car unattended is unacceptable, and therefore should be charges for that. But nonetheless, I remember Wolf was mentioning one particular situation where a Good Samaritan broke open a window. The car was utilizing the air conditioning, and the dog inside bit that person and ran out onto a highway and got killed. So unfortunately, that's the other side of the situation where a Good Samaritan might be unfortunate to encounter this, and it leads to even more heartache and sadness.
And you, Matt, you go into whatever shop you're into, and you leave your dog in the car. I'll be there 5 minutes. Some guy who, they say those dastardly do-gooders strike again, goes and smashes your car windows. This isn't a cheap thing. You're looking at hundreds and hundreds, potentially $1,000, depending on your type of vehicle. And now one of the things that you love the most in life, your pet, has bitten someone and then gets out of the car and then maybe gets killed by another passing vehicle. So it's a huge problem. And I mean, it's weird because you kind of ask yourself, well, yes, it's illegal to break into a car. Completely it is. But how would a judge see that, right? I mean, if you're acting in good faith to help someone, I don't know. It's just one of those things, So don't just do your best. My only thing is, if I'm going to leave my pets in the car, what I always do is I make sure someone else is in the car. No one's going to smash my window if I'm sitting there. So I always make sure that, I have someone else sitting in the car with me or whatever, if I have to do that. And not only that, that's a really good thing in itself, because let's say the car does get too hot, there's someone else there to take some action. So be really, really careful about that. And but for sure, all of us can be very quickly put into a survival situation simply based on overheating and exhaustion. There's Les Stroud once, we talked about, there was a video that he made where they actually videotaped him. I think he was in a desert going into mild heat stroke, so hyperthermia, which is getting too hot, and his pupils dilated and his speech slurred. And he was saying from his perspective that it was nothing. It was just he felt a little drunk and off, but he didn't actually realize the physical effects until he actually watched, like, reviewed the footage when he took it home. So it's very, 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 very serious thing to have this happen. So you have to be very careful about that. And you can put yourself into a survival situation very, very quickly, in the respect that all you basically need to do is be out working. Let's say you're out for a hike and not drink enough water. Hydration is such a simple thing. Drink water. It doesn't get any more simple than that. Even to the point where, you know, people drink these bizarre energy drinks, that Gatorade nonsense. All that is just sugar with water. And sometimes Gatorade is somehow formulated so that it will direct the water to go to certain muscle groups or things. At least that's what they tell you. But it's sugared water. You look at the label, first ingredient, water. One of the other ingredients is some kind of glucose-based substance. It's not good for you, right? So not as good for you as just pure water. So it's, you know, you don't want to put yourself in a bad spot as a result of that. I don't know your feelings about that, AD.
I totally agree, and I'm also of the mind that these energy drinks and these drinks just like Gatorade aren't very good, especially because they're sugar water. And they essentially do not work the same as water does. And water is just healthier. You don't want to get something that is essentially made for, as Wolf mentioned, more for sporting events or sporting teams than you would something that's just available to us generally. And we have to consider the fact that the human body is about 70% water. And essentially that is our sustenance. We must rely on water, and it's water that we need the most of. If we go 3 days without water, we're dead. So we need to ensure that we keep our bodies hydrated as much as possible. And there's little strategies to these things. Again, carrying a water bottle. And some people might think, oh, they're bulky. So you can actually get collapsible water bottles, and they're extremely durable. They don't have a BPA lining on the inside, and just they're extremely compact and durable. And that's something that you'd like to have when you're perhaps somewhere where you've lost the ability to gather water in some method or another, and you need a container, and you know, something like this definitely helps you. You also have to consider that certain portions of your body need to be cooled much more often than others. And your head, for example, releases a lot of heat, and that's great during the wintertime when you can cover that up and keep your body regulated by keeping a hat on. But you can't really take off any more layers than your skin, and you have to remember that these areas need to be cooled, the top of the head, the neck, underneath the arms, the groin area. The wrists, these are very important areas, a lot of nerves, and you want to also make sure that you're just splashing all over your body as well if you can. It's one of those things that isn't normally mentioned, but it's just a very good strategy to utilize. That's why a bandana is great to have, because you can always dip that in some sort of liquid, wrap that around your neck, and keep that particular hot spot on your body nice and cool so that your body maintains its heat regulation. What do you think about those strategies, Wolf, or any particular new strategy that you can recommend to our audience?
Sure. I mean, there's, you know, you see people in the deserts wearing things called a shemagh, which is basically a giant version of a Boy Scout, you know, a big Boy Scout, like a necker that they wear. It's like a big handkerchief-like thing. I think the actual definition is like a informal, non-religious turban is actually what shemagh means, if I'm not mistaken. But at any rate, and they wear them in the desert when it's really hot. And again, that is to help keep the body temperature cool by basically keeping it out of the sun. One of the strategies that I use a lot is I have a very slimline, small hydration bladder that I wear on a regular basis. And these come made by different companies like Camelback and Platypus, and there's a whole bunch of other ones out there. But Camelback is a military supplier. And basically what it is it looks like an IV bag, you know, like you have in a hospital, has a tube, goes out of the backpack, over your shoulder, and into your mouth when you want it, of course. And you can put, you know, you can get them anywhere from 1 liter to 3 liters, and you can keep water in them. And, I mean, it's really great on the go. The facility that I work at, when I'm out working with my campers or working with my staff, I always have it because you never know. And I try to make it a point to regularly take a small drink out of it. Because if you sit down and you drink 3 liters of water all at once, your body can only really absorb a small amount of that. So only a couple hundred milliliters per hour and a half hour, everything else just gets peed out. So you want to make sure that you're not like, oh, I just drank 6 liters of water before I went out on this hike. I should be fine. It doesn't really work that way. So you want to make sure you're consuming small amounts of liquid all the time to keep well hydrated. And again, you know, there are areas that you can get really bad rashes and heat rash, areas in your groin where your legs meet your torso. You know, men and women as well will often find they get bad, smelly rashes that it's called crotch rot. And they get that just from, you know, overheating in that area. So you have to be careful. Make sure you drink a lot of water. The old adage says, if you think you're thirsty, you're already dehydrated. I don't know how you feel about that, AD.
Oh, that's absolutely very true. And it proves time and time again. I remember last year I actually got heat stroke, and it definitely wasn't fun at all. I was just out of it, and I felt just very nauseous. And the only reason was because I was pushing myself in weather, in extreme weather, that I just was ignoring. I thought I could just power through, and that's the problem with the whole, you know, macho he-man mentality, where sometimes you just even ignore your own common sense and common knowledge, and you just go ahead and push yourself to a point where you just reach an exhaustion, and your body can't cope with it anymore. So, yeah, you definitely have to be mindful. Everyone really needs to be mindful, and it's just really important that these things get more attention paid to them and just become more of a habit. So, again, like Wolf was saying, consume a certain amount of water every day in small amounts will ensure that your body maintains its regulation, as opposed to just one big consumption of water where you'll end up excreting it all out and not absorbing the quantity, the necessary quantity you need to ensure that your body stays at a proper body temperature. One last thing I'd just like to mention also in regards to hydration packs that, that Wolf was just discussing was that a lot of them actually come with, instead of just a regular bag, it's sort of a pouch with Molly strapping, as we've discussed in many other episodes of the Barefoot Bushcraft Radio Show. And a lot of people have already invested, you know, good money into certain bags and might not want to buy an additional bag. So the great thing is that these Molly strappings allow you to strap this onto your pre-existing bag and ensure that you have a nice balanced pack, but you stay hydrated.
Mm-hmm. And they're available through all different retailers on the internet, your favorite surplus store. And, excuse me, I think many areas now, there's a lot of the civilian outdoor stores like Mountain Equipment Co-op and L.L. Bean and all those sort of places sell that sort of stuff as well. Now, they're becoming more and more popular because, really, who wants to carry a jug of water on your belt, like a 1-liter canteen cup or a pint or whatever it's called? You know, it can't put you off balance and everything. But, yeah, they're really great for just, like, people who are on the go all the time.
All right, so now we're going to move into our next segment.
Tips and tricks.
All right, in this week's tips and tricks segment, we're going to discuss how to create a nice fire starting kit that you can utilize in your everyday carry. So what should we have in our fire starting kits? We definitely need a various array of things that we're that could actually assist us when it comes to starting fire. Now, there's always a lighter, which is great to have. Bic lighters are known for being somewhat durable, and you can get them wet, and once they're dry enough, you can actually start them again. Unfortunately, they're not normally refillable, although you can modify them in certain ways. But just for a cheap lighter, they are very useful. But then you've got windproof lighters, which are much better because you can, in fact, refill them with butane or other flammable flammable liquids. And they are extremely good because they come out in a very strong jet. And the flame is extremely hot and allows you to spark just about anything that you would need. So that's definitely a good investment to have. But those are just materials that have already been created. Those are products that come purchased in that manner, and you should also consider natural materials, or materials that you can get for free and add to an everyday carry fire starting kit. So, for example, I'm discussing objects like dryer lint. You can get dryer lint from just about anywhere. You can even walk into a laundromat and offer to take their dryer lint for free. This stuff is extremely flammable, and one little spark, even from a very small flint, will allow that to spark up very nicely and maintain a good flame. And once you add that with something like petroleum jelly, or perhaps some sort of ethanol or type of alcohol, rubbing alcohol, for example, you can get a nice flame and hot flame going to ensure that you can get a nice large fire for whatever situation you might require it for. Wolf, what do you think about this? And can you recommend some tips for this?
Well, for sure. I mean, there's so many people out there when you get into, like, the hardcore bushcraft survival type people that they say, oh, you know, I never even carry matches. I can't even remember the last time I started a fire with a match. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's a certain pride and prowess thing to say that, and I'm no different. But if you're in a situation where you need fire, and even on the hottest of days in summer, you often will need a fire in the evening for cooking or for warmth or, you know, any number of things. Some people even believe that the cooking, you know, a fire will keep, like, wild animals away, maybe not skunks or raccoons, but predatory-type animals. But starting a fire, I think, as well as having a source of ignition, you're going to need a source of tinder. And, I mean, there's so many great things around your house that are incredibly flammable. The number one thing that I always try to use is try to get some dryer lint. And there's an abundance of it in your house, I'm sure, in your dryer. Pull out the screen, peel that stuff off. All you need to do is, again, use a, your ferro rod striker or your match or a lighter, whatever it is that you have, and you're going to get fire, and it's going to go up. And try it at home. That's something you want to take outside in your backyard. Give it a try and see how much that dryer lint will actually go up. So I always try to make sure that in my kit, even in my daily kit, I have three sources of fire. So I will have either, like, ferro rod, matches, lighter, you know, are ideal. Because you never know when one will either break down or fail, or who knows. And any number of many different things can happen that, or let's say you just use it up or it breaks over time. I mean, let's face it, most of us don't use the equipment every single day. So you're going to go and you're going to put a lighter in your kit and you're going to forget about it until you need it. So what happens if it breaks? What happens if the matches get damp? Now you've got the ferro rod. I don't know. Stuff can happen to a ferro rod as well, I suppose. Or if you're just not that skilled with it, they're a bugger to use. So, you know, it's always good to have multiple backups, like, especially for life-saving equipment, right? Redundancy is key. But there's so many things, like, you know, you can go to, I can remember once I was camping in the backcountry in a park, and for some reason it was wet, and it was snowy, it was miserable. I could not get the fire started to save my life. So I happen to have something called gasoline antifreeze, which is a kind of alcohol that you put in your fuel tank. I managed to get a fire started with that. I poured it all over the wood, threw a spark on it, whoosh, fire. I've also had where, you know, I've gotten only wet wood and I couldn't find dry wood anywhere. And I ended up finding in the backcountry like a privy, like a thunderbox-like thing, and there was toilet paper. So I harvested the toilet paper, and that will start a fire. So there's lots and lots of different stuff you can use. But dryer lint is a great source of free tinder. And we've actually, I'm sure, AD, you've had experience with the dryer lint as well, haven't you?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, going to a laundromat is a great place to pick up some free dryer lint. I've used it many times myself and just, you know, collect what I've got in my dryer and just add it to a pile and distribute that amongst all my different locations where I require fire starting, whether it be in my car or in my home or on myself in my everyday carry. Again, it's always good to have multiple caches of these sorts of things, depending on what your activities are and where you go. And if, for example, you have a cottage, you can definitely, you know, stock that sort of thing up there because it's quite known that certain cottages don't have the most reliable sources of electricity, and a lot of people also don't have generators, or generators can only work for a certain amount of time. So it's good to be able to have the option available. Another great option to consider is steel wool. And it's extremely flammable once you can get a very strong spark and high heat on there. So what you're looking for is to have super fine grade steel wool, which is usually number 0000. That's four zeros. And you can buy that at any sort of hardware store, or actually corner stores usually carry them as well. They're good for cleaning, you know, pots and pans and such, but they're just a great little addition to your fire starting kit. And you can start them up actually with a little 9-volt battery. You just put the contacts onto the steel wool, and you'll see that thing go up in flame in no time. But you should also consider the fact that a ferrosium rod has enough of a spark that it can actually set these entire steel wool on fire. So it's very good to have in case, you know, you might have carried a 9-volt battery, but it's destroyed because of an accident, or you've lost it along the ways. So just having multiple sources of tinder that you can utilize is extremely useful, especially when it comes to having it in an everyday carry or any additional survival kit that you may have put together.
You know what? So this goes to show you, when you see this kind of extreme weather, that the everyday carry kit and that your preparedness kit isn't just for the zombie apocalypse, like we said, because you never know when you are going to be in a situation where you are going to need to have a fire. You never know where you're going to need to have extra water. You know, the city that I work in was an hour and a half drive from my home. So last night I was leaving the city and I was driving out on the highways. And I could see just, I mean, beautiful, beautiful storms, massive bolts and sheets of lightning. But there were times where I was driving along the highway and I would hit a puddle of water that was so bad that, I mean, and I have a Jeep Cherokee, so it's not exactly the lightest vehicle, but it's not that heavy. I mean, it would pick the vehicle right up off the road, you know, so I was literally like hydroplaning through the through this big giant puddle of water for so many, you know, two or three car lengths before it hit the ground again. And it would be very simple in that situation for that car to go off the road and for me to have to put myself in a very brief but important survival situation, right? So if the car just went off the road, you know, I want to make sure that I'm going to be okay if I have to sit in the car for a couple of hours waiting for help. Not that I would be starting a fire in the vehicle, but if it was a longer thing, if I was on a more remote road, if I was way out in the middle of nowhere and I had no mobile phone service, what are you going to do? You know, so that's when you have to make sure that, you know, you can start a fire for either signaling or cooking or anything like that. And it's definitely possible to start fires in the rain. You just have to have the practice of doing it, have the practice of, you know, putting it all together and stuff like that. So I think that's really, really an important thing to always have your EDC or your everyday carry kit contain things for serious emergencies that can crop up just at the moment's notice, whether that be, like I say, massive storm fronts that move in. And you know, sometimes the weather reports themselves give us some complacency. Like I said, I had the weather saying, oh, it was thunderstorming out, and it was like that for 5 or 6 days. Look outside, blue skies. So it's like, well, whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get those telltale signs of, oh, look, the weather feels different outside. The tree leaves are turning over a little tiny bit. Just issue after issue that you see storms cropping in, and then bam, the heavens open and you're get dumped on. You know, so you need to be prepared for that, especially if you're hiking or camping or in an outdoor environment when really bad weather hits.
All right, so we're going to actually take a quick commercial break, and when we get back, we're going to speak to Eric Brown, Intrepid Explorer and Traveler. This is A.D. Venture and the Wolfman, and we'll see you on the other side.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from libertystickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's libertystickers.com. But wait. There's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to libertystickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. Libertystickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers. Get ready for the epic new documentary adventure ride of your life. Shade, the motion picture. A view into the globalist domain. Annabella's and Burma's film.
Nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. Governments do not operate the way you think they do. Banks do not do what you think they do. The police department is not here for what you think it is. Nothing in your world works the way you think it does.
We have to let them know the new world government has been identified, and they thought they just cloned the world economy to bring in a worldwide police state, but it's going to bring them down.
You have to stand up. Speak up. Speak out.
Shade the motion picture. Order your copy of the DVD today at ShadeTheMotionPicture.com.
This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance, available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you'll ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
Want to spread awareness to your neighbors, family, and friends about what is going on in our country today? It may be things you already know, like the large number of FEMA camps spread around this country to lock up citizens like you and me. What legislators are doing to strip states and people of their sovereign rights. Or legislation giving states the power to force vaccinate under a declared state of emergency. Do your neighbors understand what is going on? William Lewis Films offers the perfect tools to inform our population about this government's tyrannical shift from a constitutional republic to a despotic democracy. Films like 911 Ripple Effect, Beyond Treason, One Nation Under Siege, Washington You're Fired, Camp FEMA, Enemy of the State, Don't Tread on Me, Blood of Patriots, The Ron Paul Uprising, even 911 in Plain Sight, William's first production, are all available at williamlewisfilms.com. Get your DVDs today at williamlewisfilms.com. Educate against the police state.
Hello everyone, Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house. And Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants. I just love the taste of it. And this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silver Leaf Tea, it's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silver Leaf Tea.
Welcome back to the Barefoot Bushcraft Radio Show. This is your host, A.D. Venture, and I'm joined by my co-host, the Wolfman.
So we have a special guest today on our show who is a Canadian explorer and adventurer, Eric Brown. And I'd like to welcome you to calling in the show today. Eric, are you there?
I am. How are you, Wolf?
All right. Not too bad. I hope you've been enjoying our beautiful heat wave, because just a few weeks ago, everybody was saying in Canada, oh, it's so cold, when will the cold end? And now, of course, we flipped over to the other extreme.
This is very true. I don't mind it.
So, No, I love the heat myself. I just love it. You know, I'm usually in long pants and long sleeves because of the heat. People are always asking if how can you do it because you get so hot, but I love it. It's like, bring it. So, Eric, you're generally an exclusive Canadian traveler, so can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, yeah, I generally stick within Canada. For one, Canada is enormous. It's the second largest country in the world, and half of our country is extremely remote. So, to me, the possibilities are pretty well endless as far as exploring. But generally, when it comes to travel within Canada, I like to stick to those remote northern locations. And I'd have to say, like, north of the 60th parallel, which is pretty well divides our country in two, there's only about 100,000 people that live in an area that's in the ballpark of 3 million square kilometers. So if you're the kind of person that likes to get away from people and just enjoy the beauty of nature, then northern Canada is a good location.
Wow.
That's incredible. Yeah,
yeah.
There's so much to experience up there, and just like you mentioned, it's so vast that it boggles the mind to consider that only 100,000 live in such a huge area. And it must be just majestic, all the different sights and experiences that you can attain in these remote wildernesses.
Oh, absolutely. It's something drives me to explore these untouched regions. And it's quite an adrenaline rush at times as well, but I have to say it's a passion of mine.
That's great. Now, Eric, in regards to traveling in Canada, why did you decide to travel specifically within Canada versus obviously other parts of the world? Because, you know, there's other parts of the world that are also quite vast. But what was it that attracted you particularly to the Canadian wilderness?
Well, like I said, for one, Canada is so large that I could pretty well spend my entire life exploring it and still not see the whole thing. But I don't generally stick to the north necessarily. I've explored much of southern Canada as well. But just as of a few years ago, I took my first trip north of the 60th parallel into one of our three northern territories, and since then I've just decided to go there every year and see what there is to see.
Wow. And you know, it's very difficult for people, I would imagine, who haven't been there. Like, I've traveled up the Bruce Trail, and I've been to many, many remote places, to think of how vast this place is. I mean, when I drive overseas, and I can drive for 24 hours, so one full day's driving, and if I head south from my location, I will end up in Texas.
Yep.
If I'm in Europe, I will travel through up to 15 different countries, right? But if I'm in Ontario, in Toronto, and I travel north for 24 hours, I'm still in Ontario. In fact, I would end up running out of road before you run out of province.
Exactly.
Which is just almost epic in proportions. It's really the only way to describe that. So what draws you to that versus, I don't know, the Africa or Nigeria or any place like that? Like, why Canada over Colombia?
Well, don't get me wrong. I'd love to visit these other parts of the world. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. And Canada is basically home to me. So despite its size, I still feel like I'm at home. And like you said, I've driven for 7 straight days across the country, and I am still within Canada, and I'm still moving, and it just seems to never end until you hit a point where you either hit water or the end of the road, and you got to turn around and come home.
Eric, I've got to ask you, when you told me a little bit about this prior, really intrigued, and I really would love if you could share it with our audience here on Pfizer Radio. Can you tell about your last trip to the island?
Yeah, well, actually, it was a year ago right now. I was hiking through a really remote area of Baffin Island, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with, I believe it's the fifth largest island in the world. And it's in northern Canada, most of which is north of the Arctic Circle. So it's a pretty good distance north. And, I had two team members to accompany me over a 14-day period. We hiked through this valley. It was a natural mountain pass that cut through these mountains in the Arctic. And surrounding me were some of the tallest cliff faces in the world. And it was just an unbelievably gorgeous sight. And to just live within that for, 2 weeks, I'm living entirely off of my food reserves that I've carried in with me, and simply moving forward every day is quite a task when you're faced with extreme obstacles and dangers, but surrounded by that beauty, it's more than worth it, I have to say.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. I mean, the harrowing adventure of being out in the wilderness. While you're out there, so you said you were on Baffin Island.
Yep.
I mean, do you see other people? I know people, and we had talked about this briefly, who say that they have hiked the Appalachian Trail, a couple thousand kilometers, and they never really are alone.
Right.
Are you alone on these trails? Like, is there, truly, you're totally out there by yourself with you and your teammates and on the expeditions?
Well, in many cases, yeah. And for one, there aren't really much in the way of trails, more just open land, and you have to sort of know where you're going. Now, over a 14-day period, I did see a few other people. Actually, it was a team of three mountain climbers who were attempting to climb one of the tallest cliffs in the world, actually. And we spoke to them briefly, and then they were on their way, and we headed in the opposite direction. But for the most part, yeah, in these areas, you are by yourself, and if you can't take care of yourself, then, that's game over. So you really have to be prepared and know what you're getting into.
For sure. This brings the concept of survivalism and self-sufficiency to a whole new level for someone like yourself, right? I mean, you can't just be like, oh, I don't like this, and be like, hey, Mom, can you come pick me up? Once you're out there, you're out there. So you really need to hone your skills and make sure that you don't end up as a newspaper article like many things we discuss on our shows where people go missing. You must really heavily rely on your equipment out there, I would guess. So you're very choosy about what you take and everything, I would imagine?
Yeah, on a trip like that, I would generally account for every ounce that I'm carrying to the point where I will cut my toothbrush in half and limit the amount of, say, climbing rope that I bring. And even at that, I'm still carrying close to 70 pounds at the start. Of course, that lightens up over time. But yeah, you got to have the necessary equipment, the necessary gear, but you can't weigh yourself down or you're not going to get anywhere. So it's kind of a balance, and I've done a few of these sort of adventures, so I've got a knack of balancing it out, but you're absolutely right. You have to really rely on your skills. In fact, as a backup, in case of emergency, I did bring a satellite phone with me to this Baffin Island location, and 90% of the time there was no service on that, probably because I was surrounded by mountains and rocks. But had an emergency come about, there's really no way I could get a hold of anybody, and even at that, how is anybody going to get out there and really help me? So yeah, it's a bit of a harrowing situation.
And that actually brings me to another question. What are you doing in regards to polar bears? What sort of protection care do you in regards to these massive beasts?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are bears in the area. And, in fact, a lot of the local indigenous people, they warned me about possibly encountering bears. And a few options were I could carry, you may be familiar with bear spray. For one, in the location where I flew into, a can of bear spray would cost me quite a bit of money, and it's quite a sought-after item up there. And to be quite honest, I wouldn't want to carry the extra couple pounds. So basically, just being bear smart, keeping all my food in, you know, scent-free locations and scent-free bags and stuff like that, and just being aware is more important than having a defense. So, but again, you go in there knowing and accepting the risks that you may encounter a bear. Luckily, I did not, but it is possible.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. So you don't carry firearms or anything with you when you go on these trips?
Generally, no.
No.
That alone would be several pounds of weight. I like to pack light if I can.
Of course. So now, your last trip you went to Baffin Island, and you talked a bit about that. And you talked about the highest cliff faces, some of the highest in the world. So now they have these really spectacular names that are very inviting and mysterious. Could you tell us a little bit about, like, what these mountains are called?
Yeah, actually, you're right. All the mountains in this particular area are named after the Norse gods. So, for instance, the tallest cliff face in the world is a mountain called Mount Thor, the god of war. And one of the other mountains, which is nearly as tall, is called Asgard, so being the home of the Norse gods. And I forget all the names. Northumbria is another one. There are many, many mountains up there. Many of them are nameless, but many of them are also named after Norse gods, which is quite interesting.
And it must add to the mystery, Lango. That's Asgard in the distance.
Exactly.
That must be just spectacular. Wow.
Quite.
Wow, that's just amazing.
Home of the gods.
Yeah. So now, I know we have a couple more questions to ask you, of course, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So now, I know you said you didn't travel too much of the world, but I know AD and I were talking about travel costs. AD, do you want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, what kind of travel costs have you encountered versus traveling the rest of the world?
Well, depending on where I am within Canada, like I said, you can drive pretty much anywhere southern Canada, or you can fly for that matter, and with relatively low costs. But as soon as you head into the north, into the remote, your flight costs are substantially higher. For instance, the Baffin Island trip that I did, it was a two-flight, like a single connection flight to the location where I flew in, and that was in the ballpark of $3,000. Just the flight. Now, I could pretty well fly anywhere within the world for less money, but of course it's not going to be as remote or for that matter as beautiful probably, but yes, generally travel expenses in the north are substantially higher than pretty well anywhere else in the world, I would think, just due to the remoteness and everything have to have been flown in or shipped in. But yeah, that's what I would put that
out.
Wow.
That's an amazing dedication on your end to say that you would rather spend money to go and visit the Arctic, and it would cost you more to visit our Arctic in your own province than it would to go to Cuba and sit around at a resort for 2 weeks. Amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So what are your plans in the future? Oh, of course. So what are your plans? Like, what's your upcoming plans, your next adventure?
Actually, just in the near future, I'm planning on flying up to the Yukon, which is the westernmost territory in northern Canada. And And then I'm going to hike for a couple of weeks through a mountainous area. It's kind of in the central to northern Yukon area. It's I've actually visited it before, but I didn't spend a whole lot of time there, and I'd like to return and go back on the land a little more and see what there is to see. It's quite a beautiful sight, especially in the later summer as the northern autumn comes early as compared to it would in the southern, more southern. So you can just imagine miles and miles of tundra, just fire red. It's just red and orange for as far as you can see. It's just an amazing sight.
Wow. So now, of course, as you know, you and I know each other as well, but, you know, I'm not really much of a shoe person, but I'm always interested on expeditions like this. So what kind of outerwear, what kind of clothes and shoes do you wear to protect yourself? Because I'm assuming, you know, when you go, it's not 25, 30 Celsius out and you can go in just shorts and a T-shirt, or is it that warm up there? What sort of weather do you deal with and how do you protect yourself against it?
Well, it's actually, it's quite interesting because generally in the north, it's a fairly dry climate. So when it's warm, it actually feels pretty nice and pretty comfortable. So even a 10 or 15 degree day is actually quite comfortable, especially when you're hiking and hauling a lot of weight. So at times, yeah, I'll be wearing shorts and a T-shirt, and I'll be perfectly fine. But another thing in the north is the bugs. Now, you may have heard stories of giant mosquitoes and giant black flies. Well, they're true, and they're furious. So if I don't have a bug shirt or bug net or anything like that covering me, then shorts and a T-shirt can be a bit of an issue. But, yeah, as far as this upcoming trip that I'm planning, later in the summer, I don't expect the bugs to be as bad. So I'll likely be packing shorts, T-shirt, and then come nighttime, it'll cool off, and we'll have to bundle up, and hopefully I don't encounter too much bad weather, but we will see.
Wow, that's cool.
How long are you planning for that expedition?
What's that, sorry?
How long is the entire expedition that you have planned?
It's going to be about a 10-day, maybe 12-day hike is what I'm planning. It's not exceptionally long. But when you account for having to carry in all of your food and all of your gear, 12 days is pretty decent, pretty substantial. Because there's no grocery store to stock up on once you run out, right? So.
Wow. Yeah,
that sounds amazing.
Yeah. So now the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, is that something you've seen while you're up there?
Well, to be honest with you, no, I haven't. Because when I travel generally in the north, I go in the summer. And it's daylight all the time. As you get north of the Arctic Circle, the sun doesn't set on the summer solstice. And the further south you get, it's still, the sun will set, but it will be more like a twilight zone for much of the time. And, yeah, in order to see the Northern Lights, it has to be completely dark. Although this coming trip of mine, a little bit later in the year, a couple of months after the solstice, I likely will see some this time around. And that's actually the best place in the world, apparently, to view the Northern Lights. So that would be a spectacular sight.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be. I'm just trying to imagine the majesty of this landscape. It sounds so incredible. Definitely something I would love to experience at some point, and would love a chance perhaps to have you guide me through these areas. I would have to take into account, though, I would be carrying some sort of firearm because I just like to prepare a little extra, so I would have to train myself to ensure that I could carry the necessary load to carry the additional rifle.
Of course.
But nonetheless, it just sounds incredible. And it's also, I'm sure, you know, something that a lot of people have never really considered. You know, they've never really put themselves in that situation and imagined, you know, how beautiful this landscape really is, because you know, you hear stories about these things, and you might open a National Geographic and see these photos, but until you're actually there, I'm sure it just really doesn't hit you, and it's that sort of amazing majesty that I would love to personally experience and go see.
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, most people I speak to, you know, they say they're going to fly down to Florida or to Cuba or Mexico and stay on a resort for a week. And I said, no, I'm going north. I'm going the other way, because that's where in my opinion, that's where the beauty is, and it's quiet, and you can get away from the sounds of the city and all this busy, hectic life. You can just put it aside for a couple of weeks and just enjoy the world as it is.
Wow, that's pretty spectacular. It's an absolutely amazing thing that you're doing. Now, we had talked about this before, that you are thinking of doing some professional travel writing, starting some social media sites to help not only promote Canada and maybe even work with Tourism Canada, but help promote yourself and your travels. So is that that's something you said that you're looking forward to doing in the future?
Oh, definitely. Hopefully the very near future at that.
Excellent. Now, it's a big job. I mean, I maintain a very strong web presence professionally as a travel writer myself. And, you know, it takes a little while, but it's so unfortunately, you don't have a domain name registered right now that we can give out to our listeners. But I'm sure we will have you back on the show in the very near future. And you'll be, you know, maybe when you, to debrief from your next trip, if you'd be interested in that.
Oh, definitely.
And for sure, what we could do. I'm sorry?
I said I would love to share this coming trip. That'd be great.
Yeah, so now, have you considered taking things like GoPro cameras or something and making little daily video blogs that you can upload to YouTube, stuff like that? Maybe on this trip so you can compile the footage when you get back?
Yeah, I have thought about it. I always bring a camera, of course, and take many photos. In fact, photography is a bit of a hobby of mine as well. So that, in combined with these beautiful areas, makes for some nice pictures when I come home. But, yeah, I've considered bringing, like you said, a GoPro and other things with me.
Well, that sounds amazing, and we all look forward to learning more about your adventures and seeing all these great photographs that you're going to be eventually posting out there on the Internet, as well as all your future plans with traveling further remote regions of Canada. But unfortunately, we've reached that time of the day where the Barefoot Bushcraft radio show is over, but we'll see you next week right here on the Freedomizer Radio Network. This is AV Venture with my co-host, the Wolfman, and a very special guest. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric Brown, epic traveler and explorer.